I'm in 260 and the sound's not working on any of my. It's not on you. Something's wrong. Yes, any of the mics, my wireless mic, the nothing sound is working. 260. Okay. Can you guys hear me or no? Can you hear me okay? There are three handouts up in front in case you haven't picked it up, but you might have downloaded or printed those off already. So if you have, you really don't need those. One is the syllabus, one says it's projects, and the other is just the lecture notes for the first couple of sessions. So just in case you're in the wrong class, let me make sure that you are in the right class. This is valuation. Okay? So I see a lot of familiar faces. How many of you were not in my corporate finance class? Okay. Don't worry, there's not that much you miss. So, and if you really, really wanted to catch up, I gave you a way of catching up yesterday, which is... I put those mini classes on both YouTube and on iTunes U. So if you really want a review of your corporate finance class, you can do that if that is what you're inclined to do. Okay? So let me get started. I came to NYU in 1986, September of 1986. And I came to NYU, and the first class I was given to teach was a class called Security Analysis. And for those of you who don't know the history of the class, it is a very long tradition. It's a class that Ben Graham taught at Columbia in the 1950s, and you know whose most famous student was, right? That's a class that Warren Buffett said, you know, so essentially it's a class that's been on for as long as business schools have been around. And they gave me that class to teach. I took one look at that class, and I said, no way am I teaching this class. This is the most boring class I can think of. Because here's what it showed. In 1986, it had become a collection of topics. Like what? You'd spend 3 weeks on valuing stocks, 2 weeks on valuing bonds, 2 weeks on valuing options, a couple of weeks on futures, and then you'd spend 5 weeks on what were called institutional details. You know what institutional details are? Things like, what do you need to get listed on the New York Stock Exchange? Remember, these were the days before Wikipedia? So you could actually, as an instructor, go in and spend a whole hour listing 15 things that you can look up in Wikipedia today. But even by 1986, the class was showing its age. So I looked at the class and said, no, which is not a good attitude to have if you've just been hired as an assistant professor and you've got to work up the ladder. But I decided to give it a try. I went to the head of the department and I said, I'd like to teach a valuation class. And he said, don't do it. There isn't enough stuff in valuation to actually teach a class. And in 1986, he was absolutely right. There wasn't a book on valuation. There's not much academic research. As you'll see in a little while, there is no elaborate theory behind valuation, so there wasn't much academic research. So there wasn't much stuff in valuation, but I really, really wanted to teach this class. So I discovered very early in my academic life that if you want to get something done at a university, the best way to do it is to do it subversively. Because if you try to do it officially, you know exactly what's going to happen, right? I mean, you talk about bureaucracies in a DMV. Universities have perfected the act of burying things so long that people forget what's been buried. So if I'd gone and said, officially, I'd like to teach a class in valuation, here's what would have happened. They'd create a subcommittee to report to a committee, which would report to another committee. And by the time they got around to approving the class, it would be time for me to retire. So here's what I did. I said, OK, I'll teach a security analysis class. And I went in and taught evaluation class. They have no idea what I do in here. I could be talking about cooking for the next, I don't have enough stuff to fill in, but I could talk. They have no idea what goes on in the classroom. You know how long it took them to find out? 2008, I get a call from the dean's office. This is 22 years later. I get a call from the dean's office. We hear you've been teaching evaluation class. So I've been doing it for 22 years. So we have to call it what it is then. We have to call it valuation. I say, call it whatever you want. I've been using 5 different shells to teach it as evaluation class. But what I'm trying to say is, if you look at the NYU schedule, class schedule, you'll actually see valuation show up only in 2008. Before that, it was called equity instruments and markets. It was called security analysis. I basically took shells of classes, hijacked them, and made them valuation classes. So this is a class about valuation. It's about valuation, more valuation, and still more valuation. What I'm trying to tell you is, if you don't like valuation, you will not like this class. There's going to be no tangential stuff where I'm going to wander off and talk a little bit about strategy. And don't piss me off by going to LinkedIn and making me an expert. I've been noticing the last few months, people have been endorsing me for corporate strategy. I've almost left LinkedIn saying, hey, if the next person endorses me for corporate strategy is going to ask for trouble. Okay? So this is going to be a class about valuation. So let me set the game up here for those of you who weren't in my corporate finance class, a few people, so that at least you know what's coming. Right? So you know where to find me. Right? So there's my office number. My email is probably the best way to get to me. My homepage is right up there, so it's got all the stuff you need for the class plus more. Office hours are basically before and after the class, but the fair game principle still applies. Remember that? If you find me, I'm fair game. That principle still works. And in fact, the best time to probably find me is outside of office hours. Because I'm around most days, but I keep academic hours. Which means don't show up at 6:30 in the evening and expect to see me. Don't show up at 7:30 in the morning and expect. Somewhere, but my sweet spot is 10 to 4. I don't feel like working until about 10 o'clock. I don't feel like working after 4, so I kind of leave. So 10 to 4, I'm pretty much in my office. That's the good time. I might leave for an extended lunch break. That's part of the academic hours as well. Right? But I'm usually around. You can find me. And the best way to probably find me is hang out on the stairs around 9:30, because I try to take them to avoid the elevators so that I avoid people finding me in fair game. So I notice that people are incredibly lazy. They don't like to take the stairs. But that's if you hang out there around 9:30, you'll find me every single Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Weekends, forget about it. There are two teachers. Initially, there was only Scott Farmer was the only teaching assistant, but now we have two TAs. Okay? Scott Farmer and Sid are both going to be TAs for the class. Those of you in my corporate finance class, during the class, if you remember, the TAs ran some sessions starting in week 10. And for some people, it was useful. These are sessions primarily on working through problems. If you have trouble with the mechanics, those sessions were useful. I've talked to Scott and said about running those sessions for this class as well, where there'll be one session every week, which will be just mechanics sessions. We can go on and ask questions about the mechanics. So it's not, most of you might not need it, but again, it's a useful thing to fall back on. So let me talk about this class. As I said, it's all about valuation. So how much can there be in valuation? Let me explain what the range of this class is, because my intent in this class is to talk about all of the different ways you can think about value. So we're going to think about 3 different ways of value. The first is intrinsic value, where we value an asset based on its characteristics, cash flows, growth, and risk. And most people, when they think about valuation, tend to think in those dimensions. But I also want to talk about what I call pricing. And in this class, I'm going to draw a distinction between valuation and pricing. For the moment, you say, what's the difference? And if you believe in efficient markets, there might be no difference at all. But I think it's critical that we understand when you're sitting down to put a number on an asset, whether you've been asked to price the asset or value the asset. How many of you worked in investment banks over the summer? Okay. Now, a lot of what passes for valuation in investment bank is nothing of the sort. It's pricing. It's dressed up pricing, it's elaborately disguised pricing, but it's pricing. And there's nothing wrong with it, because if your job is to do transactions, you have to price, right? So a lot of what passes for valuation is pricing, but a lot of people get into trouble because they often talk about the two words as interchangeable. So I'm going to talk about pricing. The way pricing usually works is you pick comparables, you pick a multiple, you come up with a number for a company, and that is in fact 90% of what valuation is in practice. I also want to talk about one specific aspect of valuation, where if you have an asset whose cash flows are contingent on something happening, a pharmaceutical company whose value is contingent on a drug being approved, an oil company whose value is contingent on its reserves being developed, there is a place for option pricing. So three different ways of thinking about value. We'll talk about all three. I want to talk also about value from different perspectives. When you value a company as an investor, the value that you attach can be very different depending on whether you're a short-term investor or a long-term investor. The value that you attach to a company can be very different depending on whether you're an analyst or an investor. How accountants think about value can be very different from what analysts and investors think about value, and how regulators and governments, and especially in sectors where they're concerned about value, think about value can be very different from the rest of the group. So I want to talk about value from different perspectives. I also want to talk about changing value, partly from the perspective of managers running a company, saying, what can I do to make my company more valuable? And that's where you're going to see corporate finance and valuation kind of match up, because corporate finance, as I describe it, is looking at a company from the inside out, right, as managers. And what can I change in this company? How can I make better investment decisions, financing decisions, dividend decisions? That's what last spring was about. That's what a corporate finance class was about. This class, we're going to take a more passive role. We're going to look at companies from the outside in, and we're going to value these companies. You see what I mean by passive? Let's say you have a company that can afford to have 40% debt, but its managers are incredibly conservative and choose not to borrow money. And you're an investor interested in investing in the company. You can't replace the existing debt ratio with 40% saying that's an optimal debt ratio. It's not your company. You have to factor in the reality that managers have blind spots, and those blind spots would reflect how they run the company. So much of this class will be looking at companies from the outside in rather than the inside out. But towards the end of the class, I'm going to go take you back on the inside and say, okay, now you run the company. Let's think about how many more degrees of freedom you have to change the company. The reason, again, I think in terms of what your job might be after you graduate. If you're going to be a consultant, you're often on the inside helping managers, right? You're helping them. So that part of the discussion is really designed for those people who are either going to be people help, either managers themselves, or people helping managers, or activist investors. You see why it matters for activist investors? Because as an activist investor, what do you plan to do? You plan to change the way a company is run. So I want to talk about ways of changing value. And in that context, we'll also talk about acquisitions and how they show up in value through synergy and control. And finally, I want to talk about value in all of its different forms. So we're going to talk about valuing not just publicly traded companies, but private businesses, pieces of businesses, divisions, or individual assets. In fact, to show you how far we'll roam, I don't know whether you remember, but Arian Foster had tracking stock. Do you know who Arian Foster is? Those of you who don't follow the NFL. I think because of injuries, he's not even playing this year, but he was a promising running back, a 28-year-old promising running back. The age is going to matter here. Because the NFL, you kind of peak around the age of 30, so if you're a running back. And there's this company that actually made a contract with him where they paid him an upfront sum. And in return, he allowed them to issue shares, which entitled the shareholders to a percentage of the income he would generate as a running back. That's going to be an interesting security, right? So when they put together the prospectus, and they actually had a prospectus. They filed with the SEC, actually valued the Arian Foster. And for those of you who are fantasy football fans, this is your dream valuation, right? your fixation every weekend and your valuation can come together in one place. Okay? So you have to think about things like how many years does a running back have before he peaks? You know, what is his contract going to look like? And it also entitles you to a percentage of his advertising contracts as well. So you have to think about, now, what kind of public relations process do you have to increase his advertising revenues? So when we talk about valuation, it's going to be not just of publicly traded companies, but of all kinds of assets. And among publicly traded companies, we're going to talk about valuing small companies and large companies, emerging market companies and developed market companies. And I'm not going to do it in blocks where I'm going to say, now we'll value developed market company. So we'll kind of move back and forth across different types of companies, because I think one of the mistakes we make in valuation is we have silos. When we think about valuation models we use for mature companies, valuation models we use for growth companies, valuation models we use for developed market companies, the valuation models don't change. The estimation challenges might. So we're going to think about valuing all kinds of companies. We're going to value companies across the life cycle. So we're going to value companies ranging from Snapchat at one end of the spectrum. You know what Snapchat does, right? Basically, it lets you take compromising photographs of yourself, send it to other people on the delusion that 15 seconds later this will all go away, right? Okay. But you know, and the reason I bring up Snapchat is, what happened to Snapchat recently? Alibaba acquired a stake in Snapchat, which values Snapchat at $10 billion. How much did Snapchat have as revenues last year? They don't have a business model yet. They have lots of users, but no business model. So we'll value companies ranging from Snapchat at one end of the life cycle to JCPenney at the other. You see why I picked JCPenney? This is a life cycle. Just as people are born, they grow older, and then they reach a stage where they start to lose their memory and then their physical capacities. JCPenney is in that doddering, oh, mom, can't make it out of my bed. What's the thing where you hit the button? I have fallen and I can't get up. Have you seen that thing? No. So JCPenney's hitting that button like crazy. Nobody's coming. Okay? So across the life cycle, from young growth companies to distressed companies, so at the end of this class, my objective is I'd like you to be able to value any asset from any perspective using any model. Okay? So here's the setup for what we're going to cover. The first two sessions, I'm going to set the table on all these different approaches, how they approach valuation. Then we're going to spend about 10 sessions on details. And you're going to be impatient, because I'm not going to value a single company during those 10 sessions. It's going to be about getting, how do you think about cash flows and discount rates and growth rates? But if you can hang in there for those 10 sessions and kind of get those details nailed down, then you're ready to fly, because after that, you can coast. Because those are the sessions we're going to lay the foundation for valuation. So how do you measure risk? How do you bring it into your valuation? How do you measure cash flows? How does that show up? What are the best ways of thinking about growth? How do you tie up a valuation? So that'll take us through session 12. Then we'll spend about 3 sessions applying these on a variety of companies. So that's 14 sessions on basic valuation or intrinsic valuation. Then we're going to spend about 4 sessions on what I'm going to call relative valuation, but that's really the pricing part that I talked about. How do you use multiples? How do you use them? Well, I'm not going to try to talk you out of pricing. I'm not going to say discounted cash flow valuation is the only way to go. That might be the way I think about value, but that doesn't mean your job is going to allow you to do it, because as you will see, given your job description, it might require you to be able to price things, not value things. So we're going to talk about multiples. Price earnings ratio, EV to EBITDA, price to book, and essentially talk about how best to think about these multiples and how best to use them and how they often get misused in practice. Then we'll spend about 4 sessions bringing in option pricing, not to value options. That's for a different class. You have a futures and options class where you can value options till you go crazy. So you can value listed options, you can value warrants, you can value convertible bonds. I'm not interested in any of those. I'm interested in applying option pricing in the context of valuing businesses. I talked about pharmaceutical companies. I talked about natural resource companies. You're valuing Petrobras. What are you paying for? Who wins the election? This It's actually become, it's an interesting case study of how you can watch a stock price and tell what the polls were like yesterday. But beyond the political risk factor, you're buying a bunch of undeveloped reserves, right? We don't know whether those reserves will get developed. We know whether, we don't even know whether they're viable, but we're buying a bunch of undeveloped. You're buying an option. So that's what we're going to cover in those four sessions, is applying option pricing in the context of valuation. Then we'll spend a session on acquisitions. Just one session. I don't really see how you even fill an M&A class. I'll be quite honest. I don't know how you get 26 sessions on M&A. Let me take that back. The reason you're able to fit 26 sessions of M&A is you talk a lot about deal making, right? Deal structuring. You really don't talk about valuation, because there's really nothing special about an acquisition valuation other than those two words that get thrown up, synergy and control. We'll talk about what exactly they're worth. They're not just buzzwords, but what they're worth and how you come up with the number. And then I'm going to spend the session on value enhancement, which is going to tie what we've talked about valuation back to corporate finance. And hopefully in session 25, both the corporate finance classes and valuation classes, because their bookends, will come together and say, hey, you know what, it was just one big class. And it is. It's a 52-session class, but I just could never get that approved. So I kind of bundle the two classes together. So that's effectively where valuation meets corporate finance. The last session, of course, is for review. Now, in terms of getting ready, this is too late for you because this is pre-season prep, but I did send you advance warning a few weeks ago about what you will need for this class. I don't need much. I'll tell you what I'd like you to be able to do. I'd like you to be able to look at a financial statement and make sense of it. That's tough to do, actually, but on a very basic level, can you tell me the difference between operating income and net income? Can you tell me where CapEx goes? I mean, things that you should have gotten accounting, but because of the fixation on debits and credits might have slipped by. I'm more interested in whether you can read financial statements than in whether you can review the footnotes and tell me the accounting details. So my accounting prep lasts about 15 minutes, because once I get past those three cash flows, I lose, or the three financial statements, I lose interest in the rest of the statement. Okay. Very basic statistics. If I gave you a bunch of data, can you take that data and make sense of it? In what sense? Descriptive statistics, the mean, the median, the standard deviation, the classic stuff we get in Stat 101, and also ways in which you can take two different variables and tell me whether they're related through correlation, through regression. Okay, not rocket science, but enough to get by. And finally, in terms of financial tools, I will not derive the CAPM, but I didn't do it in corporate finance either. I just let somebody else do that dirty work. I'm interested in more in using risk and return models. But if you're still very, very fuzzy about what exactly risk and return models in finance are trying to do, take a look at the primer that I have on it. It kind of gives you, again, the key points that I'd like you to take away from it. Present value, of course. If you're still saying, oh, that present value thing is still giving me trouble, you're at a point that I can't even think about where to start. So take a look at that PV function and mass. If you're still struggling with your calculator, come out the winner. And finally, corporate finance, if you can, review the basics of corporate finance. So here's how I'm going to torture you for the rest of the semester. So, of course, you have class on Monday. Right after the class, you will get an email about what the class was. So that's your easy day. Every Tuesday, I'll put up what's called a valuation of the week. And let me explain what I mean by this. I'm going to make a confession. The time you're going to be spending over the next 15 weeks in this class is not the time when you're going to be learning valuation. The time you're going to be spending reading all the stuff I ask you to read is not the time that you will learn valuation. You learn valuation by doing, which means you got to get your hands dirty and value companies. Now, part of it I will force on you, because you have a project. We have to pick a company and value it, and I'll describe that project. But that's just one company. The more companies you can value and get your hands dirty on, the more you will understand valuation. Now, of course, if you have to build an entire Excel spreadsheet every time you value a company, that's going to take up 95% of your time. And who has the time to actually build one every time? So here's what I'm going to do to try to help. every week in my perverse way, so help in my, so take that help with a grain of salt. Every Tuesday, I will put up a valuation, okay? And of a company, and it's a company that I'm interested in. After all, it's all about me. So I'm going to pick a company. Well, why should I pick a company you're interested in? Because I'm doing the valuations. I'll pick a company that I'm interested in. I'll value the company. And I will put up a description of my valuation. Okay? And you're going to see what I mean by description of the valuation. It's not just a listing of assumptions, but the story I'm telling about the company. I'll put up my Excel spreadsheet with the value of the company. And then I will make the spreadsheet accessible, available to you. So I've done the architecture of the valuation, and what I want you to do is take that company and value it yourself. You say, but I don't know enough about valuation. This is the first week of the class. It doesn't matter. Give it your best shot. Initially, you might just tweak a number. You might change 15% to 15.01% because that's all you feel comfortable doing. But take a risk. You say, I don't like your growth rate. Don't bitch and moan to me about it. Just change it. Right? If you change it, the value will change. I have a Google shared spreadsheet that I've created for each of these where I'd like you to go in, and you can make up a name if you want. You can be anonymous one, anonymous two, etc. if you really feel embarrassed about what you're putting up there. But why? Yeah. Just put up your valuation and the value that you got. Let's see if we can get half the class, two-thirds of the class. I'd love to say everybody in the class valuing every company for the next 15 weeks. So to get you started, I put up the valuation of the week for this week already, because it's a Wednesday class, so Tuesday passed us by. The valuation of this week is my valuation of Alibaba. The reason I say my, again, is those reflect my assumptions about Alibaba. So if you go to the website for the class, and I'll give you the link for that, and you click on it, you'll see first a blog post I put up on the valuation from a few months ago where I describe what I think about Alibaba as a company and why I'm making the assumptions. Then you'll see the valuation I did in May of 2014 of Alibaba after the prospectus got filed. You know what Alibaba does? Somebody describe to me what Alibaba is as a company. This is going to be the most valuable IPO in history. No contest. Facebook doesn't even come close. What does Alibaba? I'm glad you said it's an advertising site because a lot of people think of Alibaba as a retailing site. They call it the Amazon. It's not an Amazon. It's not a retailing site. It's a merchandising site. In fact, if you visited one of the Alibaba sites, it's chaos. But it's chaos very closely attuned. I like the way The Economist described Alibaba. They described it as the ultimate online bazaar. And if you've gone into a bazaar, you don't get nice, organized environments, right? You get people screaming at you from every direction. You get bargaining in every place. That's exactly. You get into a site. This is the exact opposite of a Google site, right? When you open up Google, you get that nice little search box and nothing else, right? And that's what appeals to people who are nice. But it turns out that Chinese consumers like chaos, and Alibaba fed them the chaos, and it controls almost 75% of all online retailing in China flows through an Alibaba site. It is an immensely profitable company. Unlike the other, unlike the Twitters of the world that went public, you're talking about a company that last year made $4 billion in operating income on $8 billion of revenues. So for every, and that's the advantage of being an online advertising company, is you really have no infrastructure. You're not retailing, you're not having inventory. It's an immensely profitable company, and in my valuation, I kind of bring in its strengths. Its strengths are it's especially attuned to the Chinese environment, the Chinese consumer, the way the Chinese... And second, it dominates the market. Those are its strengths. You know what its weaknesses are? It's specially attuned to the Chinese consumer market, and dominates the market. You're saying, why are those weaknesses? When you have a 75% market share of a market, all of your growth has to come from the market itself growing, not from increasing market share. So that's going to put a limit on how much you can grow. You think, but they can grow overseas. But here's the catch. What made them successful in China was designing this website and delivering stuff that was attuned to how Chinese consume. I'm not sure you can. That'll transport as well. I'm not saying it won't happen, But those are going to, so that's the story I tell about Alibaba, an immensely successful company that's going to grow because Chinese online retailing is growing, but it's going to have trouble kind of expanding that model outside China. And my valuation reflects it. Okay? So when you get a chance, go to, I'll say, you know, so go in, you can click on it, you can open up my spreadsheet, you can change the numbers, and it'll come up with the value. Go into the Google Shared spreadsheet, put in your valuation of the company. So that's a Tuesday. Every Tuesday, you'll see a valuation bubble. On Wednesday, of course, you have class, and right after the class, and it won't apply this week because we won't have done enough, you'll get what's called a weekly challenge. Completely optional again, but what it will do is take the stuff we did that week, that Monday and Wednesday, and kind of push it one extra step. So let's see if you can take, because valuation, the way I describe it is, for every rule, there are 100 exceptions. Which effectively means that your skill in valuation comes from being able to take those first principles and adapt them when I give you something unfamiliar. Because you can look through the book and say, I'm going to find something exactly like this, but you're not going to find something like it. So the weekly challenge will push you one step forward. As I said, it's completely optional. That's the only part of the class what I'm going to use NYU classes for, because you can actually, when you turn in something, you can, you know. So it'll be a check. It's not, I won't grade it, I won't tell you. I'll put up my solution every Sunday, but it'll come out on Wednesday, and by Sunday the solution will go up at 6 p.m. So sometime between Wednesday and Sunday you can try your hand on it. Those weekly challenges will stay online for the entire 15 weeks. So if you fall behind a week or you don't do a week, you can always go back and try that week 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, wait till the 15th week and do all 15. Not a great idea, but you can try that too. On Thursday, I'll send you an email about your project. This is where you should be. That's it. That's my nagging email. For those of you in my corporate finance class, I'm really, really good at nagging. So I'll nag you and I'll nag you. And the level of nagging will increase the closer we get towards the end. On Friday, I do what's in corporate finance, I did an in-practice webcast, which was basically taking the corporate finance part of the project and going through an actual company. I'll do a tools webcast, where basically here I'll do something in valuation, where we've done in class, and talk about, you know, take a real company through it. So I'll put up a webcast this week, for instance, on reading a 10K. Next week it might be on estimating growth. So basically it'll be something that relates to what we're doing right then, but there'll be tools webcasts that run all the way through. On Saturday, I'll get a newsletter that kind of summarizes what we did over the week, just to kind of keep you in the loop. And then Sunday, I'll put up the weekly challenge and tell you what's coming up the rest of the week. So I think that's all 7 days of the week. So expect an email once every day, pretty much, for the rest of the semester. Okay. So the rules are very similar to my corporate finance class. You know, if you can be here, I'd love to see you all here for the entire semester, but I know that you will have other things that get in the way. But if you can be here, bring your lecture note packet. That's all you need with you. And so that, is it in the bookstore yet? Yes. Okay. If you bought in the bookstore, you can buy it in the bookstore. If you have it as a PDF file, you can have it as a PDF file. If you want to download to your iPad, I really don't care how you get it, but that's the only thing I will use pretty much consistently through the classes. And if you do miss a class, there are lots of places you can catch up. You can catch up online by clicking on one of the, I think they've changed from Echo to something else. So hopefully everything will work. I just keep my fingers crossed. Not much I can do about that. Yeah. But assuming it works, it'll show up online. It'll also show up on the iTunes U site. It'll show up at Lore. It'll show up on, I might even put it on YouTube. I'll put it in every single place. There is no excuse for you to miss a session, basically. You can be in Cotton, Albania, but if you have a broadband connection, you should be able to catch up on the class. Okay. Now, you can get by this class without a book. So if you don't have a book, it's not the end of the world. If you need a book, you can take any of my four books, you know, and I'll tell you the chapters apply. The book that is closest to being a textbook here is the investment valuation book, because textbook, in what sense? It has problems at the end of every chapter. Though it's structured as a textbook. The other three are really not structured as textbooks, but they deliver the message too. So investment valuation is just it's a hefty book. It's a book where you have to basically cover every angle, because that's what you're supposed to do in a textbook. The others, I pretty much do what I want. So De Morgan and Valuation, the first half of the book is basic valuation. That was actually my very first book, not just my first valuation book, the very first book. It's required a bit of an ego to actually put my name in there. And I wrote the book. My publisher said, "Why don't you put your name?" And I said, "Nobody will know. Can't I pick somebody else's name?" This was during the time the O.J. Simpson trial. I said, "How about O.J. Simpson on valuation? Maybe that'll better." Kardashian on valuation might work better. But it's basically the first half of the book is valuation. The second half is what I call the loose ends of valuation, things like valuing synergy, valuing control, valuing complexity, all those things. The dark side of valuation is actually my personal favorite. It's about valuing difficult to value companies. Anybody can value easy to value companies, difficult to value. So I take companies that give people trouble and say, let's think about how we value companies like this. Money losing companies, young growth companies, startups, emerging market companies, cyclical companies, commodities. And by the time you're done, you say, that's pretty much every company out there is going to fall into one of those buckets. But dark side of valuation is about, if you really want to kind of cut back on your reading, this is the little book of valuation is really little. So it was trying to compress my regular valuation book into 200 pages. My publisher wanted me to write the book without a number in the book. I said, you can't write about valuation without writing about numbers. So I kept sneaking in numbers when he wasn't looking. No, but it's $10. So if you really want to save money, save time, you can get that book as well. I have an iPad and iPhone app called YouValue, which basically does intrinsic valuation. Okay? So hopefully after you take this class, you can think of things that it does well and things that you would probably adapt from it. But I have one for the iPad and one for the iPhone. There's no Android version. There's no BlackBerry version. It's not coming. So. So if you're waiting for the BlackBerry version, you can wait a long time. But someday we might do the Android version, because it is worth it. But it turns out that the coding for an iPhone or an iPad is entirely, so you have to start from scratch. So it's essentially, it's not tweaking an existing software package. And we don't have the stomach for it, or the energy, or the resources to do it right now. Okay? Now, in terms of how you can follow the class, of course, if you're in class, the website for the class is pretty much the central domain where I'll put everything on. So that's where you'll find the links to the webcast as well. There is this lore site that I sent you the invitation to, and if you haven't accepted, please do. And finally, if you have an Apple device, you can download the iTunes U app. And if you don't have an Apple device on an Android, I think there are apps you can get. I think in addition to TuneViewer, there's something called TuneSpace. It's free, so basically you can download it. It lets you kind of watch iTunes U classes on your Android device. No. The Google Calendar for the class I sent you earlier on, so you know when the quizzes are, so don't act all surprised, which I know you will. I said, quizzes next week. Oh, my God, I didn't know it was coming. You've known it was coming since August. The Google Calendar is already out there. So if you're going to, take a look at the calendar, see when the quizzes are coming, and I'll tell you and I'll list it out as well. Now, I do have a blog where I post a fair amount of stuff about, I wouldn't say a fair amount, so I do it four times or five times a month. I post something related to valuation. So I will let you know when I post something. Now, this Twitter feed, of course, is, my corporate finance class, I've kind of encouraged you to push up the numbers. And if you have multiple emails, use them all, push up the numbers even more. I don't care, right? And there are some readings if you have extra time. And who has extra time, really, on each of the topics? In terms of how I will grade you, I haven't quite figured out the specifics, but here's my objective. Remember I said at the end of this class, I'd like you to be able to value just about anything. If I think you're pretty close to there, that's my criteria for an A. So if you're the kind of person where I say, I trust you to value, and I don't even know what you're going to be asked to value, I think you can do it because you have the capacity to take the tools and adapt them. That's effectively what I think of as somebody gets an A in this class. If you can value most things, then that's pretty good, and that's the B+. If you can value some things, then I think that this class is being a little, hasn't delivered the message. If you can value nothing, this class has truly been a waste. So basically that's what I'm looking for is when I do my write my tests, I'm writing my exams, I'm looking at the project, that's my end game. That's what I'm testing to see whether you can get close to. Now in terms of specifics, I'm going to describe the project for you in a few minutes. So that's going to be worth 30%. It's going to be a lot like the corporate finance project, but also emphasize what parts of it are not like the corporate finance project. There will be a mystery project. About what? It's a mystery. Otherwise, if you knew what it was, it wouldn't be a mystery project, which means I'll take something that's happening during the semester, which is of interest, and throw it on there. It could be anything ranging from does a Schiller PE work? And you'll have the tools to take it apart, to a breaking up of a company. Should Sony be broken up? Okay? And you have to value the pieces of Sony and say, is it worth more than the company overall? So that's going to be that's somewhere in the middle of the semester. I think the dates are actually specified already in the Google Calendar, but I haven't specified what the project is. I haven't even thought about what it is. So it's not like I'm holding it back. I just don't know yet. There'll be three quizzes, just like in the corporate finance class, one in session 10, one in session 17, and one in session 22. And they're non-cumulative, but that's really a lie, because if you think about it, if you really don't get what's happening the first 10 sessions, even if I just test you on the next six, you're going to have trouble. So it builds up. But each one will be limited to the sessions covered just prior. So sessions 1 through 9 will be October 6th. Sessions 10 through 17 will be the 29th. And 18 through 21 will be on November 17th. But basically, those will be the three quizzes. Each will be worth 10%. And the final exam is scheduled for December 12th. So that's a Friday, I think. So classes end on Monday. So your final exam is on Friday. You're done by 3 p.m. on December 12th. Now, you know the rules on quizzes, but I'm going to repeat them again because a lot of people seem to, in spite of the fact that the rules are down here, seem to think that the rules don't exist. So if you're ever in doubt about what a quiz is going to be about or what the rules are, just go back and read this page. Okay? The quizzes will be on, so please don't come and ask me to change the dates of the quizzes. I know you might be traveling. We'll talk about what you have to do if you have to miss a quiz. Okay? But there will be no shifting of dates because the logistics of doing this in a class this big is just too difficult to handle. All the quizzes will be open book, open notes. You can have your iPads because if your notes are in your iPad, obviously, you know. But no laptops, no connectivity, so for obvious reasons. So you can't have your iPad connected to your Wi-Fi chatting with your best friend who's three rows behind you. Yeah, that's not going to work. Each quiz is worth 10%. If you have to miss a quiz for good reason, know the good reasons are, right? Go back and review your corporate finance note. Good reasons are you're sick, your spouse is sick, your child is sick, mentally or physically. You don't have to show me doctor's notes. I will take your word. Which basically means if you have to miss a quiz, please be creative and think up a good reason. Okay? Don't tell me I'm not prepared, I'm feeling overwhelmed. Those are bad reasons. Okay? So basically, if you have to miss a quiz, of course you have to miss a quiz. But if you miss a quiz, here's what's going to happen. The 10%, so let me be very specific, because as I said, even in corporate finance, people have trouble with this. The 10% on that quiz will always be moved to what's left on the exam. So if you miss the first quiz, the 10% will get reallocated to the second, the third, and the final. If you miss the second quiz, that 10% will get reallocated to the third quiz and the final. If you miss the third quiz, it will get reallocated entirely to the final. And you know why I have to do that, right? Because otherwise you get strategic quiz missing, which is you do really well in the first two quizzes. It actually makes sense for you to miss the third quiz then because it makes your first two quizzes worth more. So that can't happen. So it'll always be moved forward. So you're saying, what's the cost of missing a quiz? The cost of missing a quiz is when you do all three quizzes, your worst quiz score gets marked up to the average on the rest of your exams. So if you get 2 on your worst quiz, and you get an 80% on all the other exams, not the project, but the two, I'll mark the 2 up to an 8, which is a big plus, especially if you have one bad quiz. Seeing what happens if I have 2? Well, the worst quiz will still get marked up, but then you still have a bad quiz. So it gives you one pass. One of those quizzes, we had a bad day and bad things happened to you, that meltdown will be covered if you do all three quizzes. I grade all your quizzes, so don't go to the TAs if you're not happy about a score. Come to me, show me what you think is missing. So, you know, so the grading will all be done by me, and you can bring calculators and iPads and whatever else, abacuses, whatever you want to bring with you. Okay? But those are the basic rules. I think they're pretty comprehensive. If you think of some twist that I've missed, that's really bugging you about the quiz, let me know. But there'll be, as I said, try to take all three quizzes if you can, because it does give you that advantage of taking out the worst quiz. Now, we're going to talk about the project in a while, but that 40%, that's a group project and a mystery project, is group work. Which means that you have to start thinking about finding a group. I will not put you in a group unless we get to that stage where I have to, and even then, no, we'll talk about it. But you know enough people in the class that if you haven't made yourself completely unlikable in the first year, you should be able to find a group. Okay. The groups can be 5, 6, even 7. If you really are 7 people, like the 7 dwarves, you have to hang out together. You like being together. Be my guest. I think about 5 is probably a good size for a group. And one of the things I recognize is by the time you get to the second year, you really don't want to hang out with other MBAs as much as you did in the first year. Somehow the bloom is off the rose. So there's less group work in this class's group project than there was in corporate finance. In fact, you can probably get by without even talking to each other for the next 12 weeks. Maybe a little email here and there, you know, kind of make sure that they're still around, they haven't moved on, dropped the class, etc. You know, so I understand that you don't really want to get together. That group feeling is not that good anymore. So that's built in. There will be one grade per group, and so if you have somebody who's not dragging their feet, don't come to me and ask me to punish them, because I can't do that. And police your own group. So basically, that's your job. You think, what happens if I cannot find a group? If you cannot find a group by Friday, please let me know, and I will put you on an orphan list and put you up for adoption, just like I did in corporate finance. So we'll have a list of orphans. Say, these are sort of other groups, or groups of 3, groups of 4. So I'd like an orphan in my list. You know. And there are advantages to groups adopting orphans, as you'll see in a little while. But don't worry, you will be in a group whether you feel like you're up to it or not right now. So the exams and quizzes are individual work, and so we talked about the quizzes. And all participation is welcome. This is a small enough room that you should not be as intimidated as you might have been in Paulson, because Paulson is scary to participate in. It's like being in a pit. You know? Everybody can see everybody else. Everybody can hear everybody else. So I will try to repeat your questions, because otherwise the webcast don't pick it up. But sometimes I will forget. So please ask your questions loudly. Hopefully everything will get recorded. I think there are actually mics hanging from the ceiling. We had to play with them last year, because when they built this room and they put the mics in, they were too sensitive. They were picking up noises that should not be picked up. And noises like side whispers or drinking out of a cup really loudly, or I mean things like that. So I think they've done much better. So it's actually a nice room to pick up that conversation. So that's the intro stuff. Let me talk a little bit about the project. So here's what your project is going to be. As I said, you have 2 projects. One is this valuation project that stretches all semester, and the other is a mystery project. Okay. So my intent in the project is very simple. It's not to give you busy work, but for you to be able to take the things we do in class and apply it on a real company in real time with real numbers. I don't believe in cases. I think it's absurd to even have a case in a valuation class when you've got 40,000 live cases out there, right? So you have 40,000, I think last year there were 41,000 publicly traded companies. So you have your choice. You can pick any of those companies. In fact, I'll go further. If you want to value a private business, your family business, a relative's business, a friend's business, you can do that too. With one caveat, just make sure you can get the financial statements from your family. If they shut you out and say, I don't want you to see the financial statements, you first have troubles with your family, which you have to deal with. But I think it's a great way. In fact, we've had, I think in this class, six private companies that have been valued that have gone, that have been IPO'd. Now, one of them, for instance, familiar with UFC? Lorenzo Fertitta, who's the CEO of UFC, actually went through this class 20 years ago, and he valued his casino, Palace Station Casinos, which is a Vegas-based casino, for an IPO in this class. So if you have a company that's big enough to go public, save the investment banking fees. This is costing you almost as much anyway to get an MBA. Right? So do the valuation. So pick any company. The one thing I will not do is I will not pick a company for you, because then you could, and I know when you pick a company, you're going to try to pass it by and say, is this a good company to value? Let me save you the trouble. Every company is a good company to value. There'll always be something interesting you will find. So pick a company you're interested in. Don't pick a company because it's going to be easy to value or because you're really going to be able to value it quickly. Pick a company you're interested in, and it can be anywhere in the world. But I'll add a few constraints across the group. It is a group project, and each person is to pick a company. So if you have a group of seven, guess what? You have seven companies in your group. So you're saving nothing as a group of seven, if you think about it, because each person still has to value a company. The valuation is due in two parts. The first part of the valuation is due back on October 24th, but before you freak out, it's not going to be great. So essentially, it's a feedback saying, well, so that's going to be your initial intrinsic valuation of your company, your discounted cash flow valuation. I'm going to give you a chance to bounce it to me, and I'll bounce it back to you. So it's just an Excel spreadsheet. So it's not a report. An Excel spreadsheet. I'll take a look and say, this might need to. So it's usually a couple of tweaks where I'll put a comment, right? So I won't make the changes for you, because that'll ruin your valuation. I'll say, you might want to think a little bit more about this growth rate, or this return on capital, or this margin you're assuming in steady state. Okay? What happens if you don't do that intermediate? Really nothing. I'll be quite honest with you. I'm not saying the only thing will happen is if you turn that valuation in as your final valuation and there's a fundamental flaw and you did not give me a chance to give you feedback on it, you're kind of sunk. But if you feel incredibly confident in your valuation capacities, you don't have to do it. The reason I have this mid-semester, and it's particularly critical in the spring semester when I teach this class, is in the second year you have this, what I call, it's I don't know what to call it, premature graduation is what I call it, which is somewhere midway through the year you actually have graduated mentally. Right? You're out of here. You're already making millions of dollars out there. Now you're saying, I have to last out till May. So what I tried to do is, and that especially in April of May of 2015, you've gone. You're not even here anymore. So especially in the spring semester, this mid-semester, it forces you, if nothing else, to get a valuation done and get it back to me. The final project report is due by 5 p.m. on the last day of class, which is December 8th. So here are the steps in it. First, if you can start this process right now, actually, even before you pick a group. You have to pick a company, okay? Now, of course, as I said, everybody in the group has to pick a company. I'm going to add some constraints across the group. So if I look across a group, I need to see at least one company that's a money-losing company in your group, at least one company which has high growth potential, either in terms of revenues or earnings, and I'll give you a lot of flexibility in determining what high growth is. At least one non-US company, and no cheating, no valuing the ADR or the local listing. I want you to value the company in its local listing, in all its local glory, whatever currency you have to deal with, because I want you to be able to deal with Indonesian rupiah or nominal riyal or Indian rupee. So I want you to value at least one non-US company and one service company. The way I define service, 80% of companies are service companies. So really, retail companies are service company. Software company could be a service company. So basically, at least one service company. So at least one money-losing company, one high-growth company, one non-US company, one service company. Now, remember I talked about the orphans? Here's one way. You can make the orphan carry and have an overload. You all pick nice phone companies with big dividends and small growth, and you take 15 minutes to value a company. You add a fifth person on, that orphan will be given the foreign money losing high growth service company. So you do that. So, you know, there is advantages to waiting and adding an orphan and giving him or her the kind of brunt to carry. But I'll give you some advice. If you want to understand valuation, go where it's darkest. You know what I mean by darkest? Pick the company where everybody says, no way you can value that company. Okay? Pick Airbnb. Pick Tesla. Pick Twitter. Pick those companies where people say, oh, I can't value that company. Okay? So that's the first step. Second, you're going to do an intrinsic valuation of the company. And I'm going to give you my definition of intrinsic value, not just an automatic DCF model. I'm going to make a big deal about having a narrative for your company. I firmly believe that every good valuation builds on a story. And we'll talk a lot about this. Is part of what I want you to be able to take out of the class, is valuation shouldn't be just collections of numbers. Okay? So I want you to start thinking about the narrative for your company. And I'll give you examples of narratives as we go through, because every valuation has to have a consistent narrative dying. You've got to tie the narrative to key numbers in your valuations. If you tell me that your company is going to be an explosive growth company in a sector, you have to think about why. Then you have to think about the numbers in your valuation that you use to reflect those strengths, and then show me a valuation. So I'm not just looking for a collection of numbers, because anybody can model. Very few people can value. Modeling is just Excel spreadsheets. A lot of people who claim to be valuation experts are really experts in Excel. I don't know whether any of you have taken the Training the Street sessions. They're very good sessions, technically, on building spreadsheets. They teach all the nifty little tricks on modeling. But it's not valuation. So one of the things I want you to start to develop is that skill to connect that narrative to numbers. So that's the part that's due October 24th, is the intrinsic valuation. So the end of step two, you're going to have an intrinsic value for your company. Step three, I want to value a company relative to other companies in the sector. Do you see the difference between step two and step three? Step two, I want you to focus just on your company, do an intrinsic valuation of your company, don't worry about the rest of the world. Step three, I'm saying forget about cash flows, growth. Tell me how you'd value a company given how other companies in the sector are being priced. You see the distinction with Snapchat? Snapchat intrinsic valuation might be building up revenue models, cash flows, incredibly difficult. Snapchat, the relative valuation might be number of users, and saying this is how much the market is paying per user for a social media company, and this is the price. So effectively, this part of the valuation, you're going to be picking a multiple, picking comparables, and pricing your company. Then I also, so at the end of step three, you're going to actually have now two values for your company, an intrinsic value per share and a relative value per share, a price per share. Then I want to value your company relative to the entire market. Again, the distinction between step three and step four might seem like, what's the difference? Step three, I want you to value your company relative to its sector. Snapchat against social media companies. Tesla against automobile companies. In step four, I'm going to say, look, value a company relative to how the rest of the market is being valued. Can you get a different answer in step four relative to step three? Sure, right? In step three, let's say you're in a sector that's immensely overpriced. Your company might look cheap relative to other social media companies and look expensive relative to the market. So at step four, you're going to get a third valuation for your company, which can be different from the valuations you got in step two and step three. So you're now going to be carrying three numbers for your company forward. Step five, for some of your companies, I'm actually going to give you a chance to get a fourth number for your company, saying think of your company as an option and value company. It's a natural resource company. And for a small subset of your companies, you're going to get a fourth number for your company, which is different from the numbers you got from the intrinsic valuation, the sector valuation, the market valuation. See, what am I going to do with all of these? Step six, I'm going to make you use all four numbers. So now, tell me based on your numbers for this company, whether you'd buy the company or sell the company. And no weaseling out here. Know what I mean by weaseling out? No weak buy, I'm thinking about buying, semi-strong buy. You either buy or you sell. you see the potential challenge you might face? You get four different numbers for your company, right? There's a market price. You're saying, what if two of my numbers are lower than the price and two are higher? You get to choose. What will it be based on? It'll be based on faith. Which of these numbers you have more faith in? And I'm not going to point to you and say intrinsic valuation is the number. It's up to you to make the decision. You might decide after doing an intrinsic valuation of pricing of Snapchat that you trust the pricing more than the intrinsic valuation. And you might tell me to buy or sell based on that price. That's perfectly fine. But I want you to make that choice and think about why it is that you get different numbers from intrinsic and relative valuation and which one you will trust if you're an investor in the company. So that's basically the big project. It'll run through the entire semester. As I said, the process starts right now. Start thinking about interesting companies. Okay? And the rest of the class, essentially. I will not, remember in corporate finance, I took entire segments of the market off the desk. I said, you can't do a money-losing company. You can't do a financial service company. There are no rules here. You can pick any company you want, private or public, small or large, right?
When you say non-U.S. companies, it's not listed on the stock exchange or?
Oh, non-U.S. in the sense. You pick any company listed on any exchange.
So can we do a Chinese company listed on the U.S.?
You can do a Chinese, like Baidu or,
yeah,
or like variable.
Baidu.
Yeah, you can do it. That actually counts as a U.S. company. So basically, I would still penalize you and ask you to do a Chinese company. That's fine, though. It's, if you really want to make Baidu your Chinese company and the listing is in the NASDAQ, because Baidu is not listed anywhere else, that's okay. Yeah.
If you're looking at private companies, is there sort of a guideline on how much information you feel should be available to be able to do
no.
the project?
No. As long as they give you all the information they have, I'm okay with it. So if all the information they have is, I know what I made as revenues last year, I know what I made as income, I don't have an income statement, I can live with that, because that's reality, right? But if they have the full income statement, they say, I'll show you only the revenue number and this bottom line number, the net income, it's probably not good, because they're whole. So in a sense, if you're going to value a private company, try to get access to all the information that's available, which will vary depending on the private company. Yes? This is a themeless group. You know, basically in corporate finance, I said pick in the same, you know, but I was so loose about the theme here that you could even there, but here there's no, you can pick five very different companies in different countries and different businesses. There's no advantage to having companies within the same sector. Maybe some macro research that you do can be shared, but I really don't care. So you have, that's why I said you can start thinking about the company right now. You don't have to wait till you're part of a group. And especially if you think about a young growth, money-losing company, you're golden, right? Because you are that, any group is going to say, and remember, you're not limited to, so if you want to do all five young growth, money-losing foreign companies, be my guest, okay? It's actually, and in fact, many of you picking these young technology companies, don't be surprised if all your companies end up in that space. So that's, don't view that as a constraint on the upper side. You can basically have as many young growth, money-losing companies as you want. Yes?
Does a company which has operations in the U.S. listed on NASDAQ but is incorporated?
Is this to meet the constraint? You can pick, as I said, does it meet the constraint? Is that what you're saying? Does it take care of your foreign? Does it do the checkbox? If you really want to. Okay. It doesn't make me happy because I'd like you to deal with local markets, and because that's part of the reason I want you to do foreign companies is I want you to think about countries you might not normally have in your, you know, more normal. So try to stray. That's why I'm saying go where it's darkest. And pick a Venezuelan company. You will go crazy by the end of the semester. Hey, but do it anyway. And the reason I did, there are people in Venezuela who have to value Venezuelan companies. So this becomes your skill set. Is I can value companies in countries with crazy governments, which might nationalize me at any moment. You have a competitive advantage. Your services will be deeply sought in the Ukraine, Russia, Venezuela, Argentina. And that's a big chunk of the world. You can make yourself valuation specialists in crazy markets. Okay? So don't view the constraints as a bad thing. So go looking for companies like those in most of your groups. You will end up with too many of those companies, not too few. Because you think about companies that you're reading about that interest you, They're not the boring, mature, money-making, stable margin companies. They're companies where strange things are happening, right? So trust me, these constraints never bite, which is you're never going to be, or they seldom bite in a group that you can't find a foreign company. Any other questions? Okay. Mystery project, as I said, I'll let you know when we get there. Right. So I know we're pretty close to, but I'm going to get started on I told you when I started teaching valuation here in 1986, when I first started teaching valuation, I made the mistake of assuming that everybody else was as interested in valuation as I was. I've discovered in hindsight that that was a terrible mistake. I've discovered that most people don't believe in valuation. And by most people, I include most people who do valuation for a living, really don't buy into it. See, but they do it all the time. They do it because it's their job. They do it to cover their rear end. They do it to keep from getting sued. But they really don't believe that this actually means something. So if you talk to an analyst and say, why is Google trading at $600 per share? Why is Apple trading at $102 per share? And you scratch the surface, the answer you're going to get is because that's what the market thinks it's worth. Most people who do valuation think it's a waste of time. So what I'd like to do is start this class off by telling you why I do valuation. Because if I thought it was a waste of time, I wouldn't be teaching this class. So here's why I do valuation. I do valuation to fight the lemming in me. I don't know whether you remember lemmings, but lemmings became famous or infamous in a Disney movie in the 1950s. There are all these stories about what exactly happened. I really don't know the inside story. But in the movie, hundreds of big, ugly, rat-like creatures, that's what lemmings look like, gathered together on a cliff, run right off the cliff into an ocean and commit collective suicide. And ever since, one of those big questions has been, why do they do it? What drives them off the cliff? I don't know the answer, but let's do some virtual imagery. You can see why the first lemming did it, right? He was going too fast, he couldn't stop, off the cliff, into the ocean. Incidentally, these guys can't swim. That kind of seals the deal, dead. Second lemming, too close to the first guy, also in the ocean, also dead. But I'd like you to put yourself in the shoes of the very last lemming in that group. I know lemmings don't wear shoes, but kind of hang in there with the analogy anyway. Right? So you ready? You're the very last lemming in your group. You're running as fast as you can towards the cliff. It's right there. Your entire tribe has just disappeared off that cliff. You're the only person left running towards that cliff. I would think you'd have second thoughts about what you were just planning to do, right? Your left brain, right brain, whatever part of you is rational, saying, stop, stop, stop. But then you hear this voice in the back of your head. You know what it's saying? They must know something that you don't. Remember those seven words. They're the seven most deadly words in investing in valuation. They must know something that you don't. You know when you hear it? Let's pick a stock, Tesla. The big winners of last year, right? 440%. It's up to 285 yesterday. Let's say you do an intrinsic valuation of Tesla and you come up with $100 per share. What's your rational side saying? Don't buy that stock, right? But then you hear this voice pipe up in the back of your head. They must know something that you don't. It speaks in a monotone. Don't ask me why. And when you hear those words, magical things start to happen to your valuation. Your growth rates start to nudge up, your discount rates start to go down, your cash flows start to expand. It's almost like it's happening on its own. And the 100 goes up to 120, 140, 160, 180. You can't even believe this. It's happening right in front of you. And you're not going to stop till you get to 285, right? Don't fight it. There's a lemming inside each and every one of you dying to get out. Get it out. In fact, you can divide the whole world of investors into three groups of lemmings. The first group I call proud lemmings. I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming. They call themselves momentum investors, but it's pretty much the same thing, right? What do? They look for a crowd and they join in. You're buying, I'm buying. You're selling, I'm selling. Why am I buying? I don't care. I can't even imagine going up to somebody saying, I am a momentum investor. Might as well say, I'm a lemming and I'm proud to be a lemming, right? The second group of lemmings I call Yogi Bear lemmings. Did you see that movie that came out, Yogi Bear movie? My kids refused to go to the movie with me, but I went anyway. Okay? It's like 6 years ago. one of the worst movies ever made, I think. But I went because I used to remember the comics I used to read with Yogi Berra. And if you remember his most famous saying, it was, he was smarter than the average bear. Yogi Berra lemmings think they're smarter than the average lemming. Here's what they want to do. They want to run with the crowd to the very edge of the cliff and the last moment veer away. Admit it, you're tempted. He's saying, I paid $200,000 for an MBA. I'm smarter than the average investor. I know where the cliff is coming. I've taken Nouriel Roubini's class. And you're tempted. In case you're tempted, remember after every market crash, what do you hear? People saying, I saw it coming. So how come you never mentioned? You were on CNBC every day for the last 3 years. It kind of slipped my mind. After every crash, it's always obvious. Nobody knows where the cliff is coming, when the cliff is coming. I can't pull off being a proud lemming. I am definitely not a Yogi Berra lemming because I have no idea when the cliff is coming. If you ask me to describe myself, that's me. A lemming with a life vest. That's, if you ask me to put a picture for this class, that is our objective in this class, is at the end of the class, hopefully you will have a life vest. Know what the life vest is? That if you understand the basics of valuation, you'll have something else to hold on to, even if everybody else changes their mind. Because guess what? If you really, really, really want to buy something, you're going to find a way to buy it. Of course, you're human. You will. Our capacity for self-delusion is limitless. And if we really want to do something, we're going to find a way to do it. All that this class hopefully can do is slow the process down. And while the process is slowed down, it'll give your rational side a chance to mount an argument. And 9 times out of 10, guess what you're going to do? You're going to ignore it and do what you wanted to do in the first place. I can't stop you there because you're human. But maybe that 1 time out of 10, when you've slowed the process down and given yourself a chance to think through the process, you say, that doesn't make sense. That's what all of this is about. It's not to make you a rational investor. That's an oxymoron. You're a human being. You cannot be rational. You're incapable of being rational. All you can do is provide some balance to that process where everything's being driven by emotion. So philosophically, what I'm arguing for is if you're an investor, you need to invest based on an estimate of value. If you're a trader, then all bets are off. Let me stop and ask a question. How many of you are, I know right now you might not be in a position wealth-wise to even think about this, but assume you're wealthy now, and you get a choice of being in, how many of you would classify yourselves as investors? How many of you would classify yourselves as traders? I think one of the problems is already in your mind, investors are the good people. This is what happens because of this value investor stuff, because they make it seem like they're the righteous ones. Okay? If you're a trader, you must be a shallow person. You must be a person who... Now, that's the message that's been delivered, and it's a bad message because if you make $1 million trading, and I make $1 million investing, guess what? We both get to buy exactly the same things. So I don't care how you make money if you make money. So one of the things I hope to deliver in this class is if you're a trader, the valuation tools you might get out of this class are not that useful because you're interested in pricing. But hopefully those tools can be carried into the pricing process so you can become a better pricer. Because the reason I bring that up again is that if you read a lot of equity research reports, as you read the report, it's quite clear that they're not thinking about the stock anymore as an investment. They're thinking about it as a trading opportunity. Okay? So for instance, this was from an equity research report in January 2000 when Henry Blodgett was an equity research analyst at Merrill Lynch. And this is what he had to say about a dot-com stock that had hit $174 that day. It had no revenues, no earnings. And he said, valuation is often not a helpful tool in determining when to sell hypergrowth stocks. You know what? He's both right and wrong. He's right because when you're in stocks like this, it's all about trading and mood and momentum and pricing. valuation becomes a side story. You can be frustrated about it. You can talk about how irrational people are. But that's the reality. So again, one of the things we'll go through in this class is, you know, we'll talk about when it's okay to give in to that momentum argument and when you might want to counter that argument. Because if you justify a price purely based on momentum, you know what the danger is? Can momentum shift? It can happen in a second. Nobody knows why it happens. That's the cliff. So as we start this class, I'm going to start you with a question. It's a question that some of you might have preconceptions already about this. Okay. So here are my choices. This is a class for the next 15 weeks. We're going to talk about valuation. We're going to talk about some discipline. Might as well nail down which side it falls in. So here are my choices for you and how you can think about it. Is it a science? Is it art? Or is it magic? Let's start with, is it a science? Is valuation a science? What's the essence of a science? Take physics. Physics is a science, right? No debate about it. What makes physics a science? The laws of physics are immutable, right? So you go to the 11th floor of this building and you jump up. I don't care whether you're Peter Henry or you're a lowly first-year MBA. You're going to hit the ground at about the same time. The laws of gravity apply to all of us. So the essence of a science, it's input-output. You tell me what you've estimated, I can tell you what the output is. Valuation is not a science. There's too much stuff that happens in the middle. So if you say, look, I put all these inputs in, what should the output be? Yeah. Or I got all my inputs right, will I get the output right? I can't tell. So it's not a science. That's good. You know why it's good? Because if valuation were a science, then you wouldn't need any human beings. I mean, I could build a computer model to value companies and I wouldn't need you. So it's a good thing it's not a science. Is it an art? What's the essence of an art? You really can't teach it. You're either Picasso or you're not. You and I could paint noses in the sides of faces from now through eternity and people are not going to pay $3.5 million for it. Thank God valuation is not an art, because if it was an art, I wasted, 28 years of my life teaching something that should not be taught. Is it magic? It's like a Harry Potter. No, maybe we're going to... No, it's really not. So I was cheating. I didn't give you what I think valuation... I'll tell you what I think valuation is. Valuation is a craft. I'll give you the two things that come closest to valuation to me. Carpentry and cooking. Say cooking. How do you learn cooking? By watching the Food Network? You can watch it. I see exactly how. I still remember the first time I tried to bake something, I read the directions that whip the egg whites into some. What do you mean whip the egg whites into something? You know, so they're supposed to stand up by itself. I look at the liquid and said, no way is this ever going to stand up. But I tried. You learn cooking by doing. Not by watching, not by reading, but by doing, right? You pull the skillet out, you whip something until it does whatever it wants to do, and then you make it, and maybe it falls on its face. You can watch YouTube videos about how to make a shaker table. You can watch every YouTube video ever made, and there's probably one, right? But until you've actually sat there with those tools and tried to nail something in, you discover that it's not as easy as it looks. You learn valuation by doing. And that's part of the reason I'm going to kind of push this notion of, don't just take that one company of value and say, I'm done, that's all the class requires. Because if you really want to learn valuation, here's my suggestion. Value every one of the companies we're going to do for the next 15 weeks. When the class ends on December 12th, forget that the class actually ended. Keep valuing the company every week for the rest of your life. Two things are going to happen. One is it's going to get easier because the architecture of valuation is such that you don't have to relearn the basics. And second, every time you value a company, even if it's the 5,000th company you valued, you will learn something new. I still learn something about valuation every time I value a company. That's what keeps it new and fresh. It's a craft. So keep that in mind, because you'll hear people saying valuation is an art. So basically, you'll have people throwing around words. It is a craft, which means that you have to work on the craft. You will never perfect it, but you will get better at it the more you work at it. So I'm going to leave you with this slide, because I'm going to start off with this next. I think a lot of people who come into valuation classes expect to see numbers, and you're going to see a lot of numbers in this class. But you're going to be surprised at how much storytelling.